I bet you didn't know that the teaching of Latin in schools is making a comeback. Latin? Really? Isn't that a dead language? Well, take a look at what studies say about how well Latin students do on a test like the SAT. Memoria Press's Latin program will revolutionize your students' vocabulary, knowledge, and their understanding of grammar. And there is no better subject for teaching critical thinking skills. Visit MemoriaPress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR.
Nobody says to the abortion choice crowd, you're not pro-choice because you're not for all choices. You're not for school choice. You're not for tax cut choice. You're only for abortion choice.
The only way to explain why every moral, familial, sexual standard that had been there for thousands of years, why they all came under attack at the same time, the only explanation, the gale of satanic force.
Evolution is the creation story of modern man, so it explains in principle everything, although it doesn't really explain anything.
The point of pure doctrine is simply to have more of what God wants to give.
Clinical scientists working the night shift in Chicago love listening to Issues, Etc.
Well, with almost two dozen candidates in the field for the Democratic presidential race, there's going to be some unusual things. There's going to be names that you don't know and probably will very easily forget. There will be names that perhaps you don't expect. One of those names was Marianne Williamson. I know that name because she popularized a kind of new age book called A Course in Miracles. She did not write it, but she popularized it again, back in the 90s and the early 2000s. So I know that name, but I don't know why she's running for president. And I watched her in the Democratic presidential debate, and there was some hints at her new age views, but I only saw one send-up of it on late night television. And I haven't seen very much critical news coverage of her religious views, her new age views. Why is that? Greetings and welcome to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Thursday afternoon, the 11th of July. Terry Mattingly joins us to talk about media coverage of the religious beliefs of Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson and former presidential candidate, the late Ross Perot. Then a little bit later, we'll be continuing our series introducing the books of the Bible. We are going from Old Testament to New Testament. We'll introduce the book of Matthew with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller. Feel free to join us with questions or comments. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, our Twitter address @issuesetc, and the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about media coverage of the religious beliefs of Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson and former presidential candidate, the late Ross Perot, Terry Mattingly, senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion, and founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
So why did you require seminary students to read this classic 1992 Williamson book, and how did they respond?
Well, ironically, I wanted them to read that book for many of the same reasons that I think it's important that she is now involved in the early stages of the Democratic Party's presidential race. And let me answer both of those questions by asking you a simple question. I know you just love it when I turn around and ask you a question right back. Would it be a bigger deal if the candidate in the debate's name was Oprah?
Oh, that's a very that's a very good question. Would the religious views be a bigger deal?
Political news, cultural news, religious news.
It would be the news of practically of the early part of the century, wouldn't it?
If Oprah was standing up there at the podium,
everyone else would have to go home.
Marianne Williamson.
Yes, everyone else would have to go home, including Joe Biden. It would be over with.
Okay. Why is that? Well, it's because A, she's immensely popular. B, in her case also, she has this astonishing ability to swing a constituency from African American church pews all the way to suburban women's yoga classes, right? And everywhere in between. This is absolutely, positively massive cultural clout in the United States. So when I ask my students to read, I required them to read A Return to Love. I was making seminarians at a Baptist evangelical seminary read for a class on media era apologetics. I was requiring them to read A Return to Love. And the reason I did is because Oprah was holding up Marianne Williamson as, in effect, a new prophet, prophetess, whatever, for our age. And this was right as Oprah was rolling into a stage of her life and career where she was much more upfront about her religious views. And she was doing like a weekly show with candles lit all over the stage, and she's raising her hands and praying to the universe and asking women around the country to join her in reawakening their soul and their spirituality. Well, Marianne Williamson, in many ways, is Oprah with even more candor about some of the religious issues and social issues, and she has put them in print. So that's why I wanted students to read it. And trust me, they were not amused at all. They thought this was an absolute joke, that I wanted them to try to take seriously the religious and theological points of view of this woman and what she was doing with the book, A Course in Miracles. And they were saying, this is just New Age. Nobody cares about this. The students who were more open-minded immediately started going back to the churches where they were members, or in some cases, pastors, and asking women at their church, have you heard of Marianne Williamson? And they were all going, oh, of course, she's on Oprah. Now, she's a little spacey, but I think what she's saying is really positive. And this makes me feel like there's more hope for our world and for America. And then you ask some specific issues. What about her views on sin? Well, I haven't noticed anything specific about that. What about her views on every person being a son of God, and thus they're not capable of sin, and what they do is not real? And she goes, well, isn't that Christianity? People would say. Now, when we see polls by Lifeway and Barna and others that talk about the rising percentage of evangelical Christians in America who, within their religious worldviews, have extremely unconventional theological beliefs, I think you need to say that we're watching decades of impact by Oprah Winfrey and people similar to her, but and specifically Marianne Williamson. Now she's running for president. And once again, nobody wants to take this seriously. And I'm not sure how seriously we should take her in terms of her ability to beat the Democratic structure and become a finalist, but could you see her being mentioned as a cabinet official?
Sure.
Of course. Now, the other thing here that I want to bring up is, I mean, are we going once again to say, look, I know they're charismatic, I know they're popular, I know they have lots of fans, and I know they're really good at TV, but no one like that could be elected president of the United States? Right? Surely at this point, we're a little bit more willing to admit that we are now a talk show celebrity nation, and that name recognition and what this strange thing is that people call trust and identity with that face looking out from the screen at you and saying, I understand what you're going through. There's not that much difference between a Marianne Williamson and a, dare I say it, evangelical televangelist. And America is not a nation that sweats the doctrinal details, are we? I mean, other than that 18 to 20 to 22% of the nation that's actually attempting day by day by day to practice some traditional form of religious faith. So 80% of the nation is out there. And you say, well, I mean, but she's so spacey and New Age, surely she wouldn't appeal to the hardcore atheist, agnostic, religious liberal crowd. Well, she's with them on all of the key political issues. From the very beginning, one of the big themes of her work has been that sin is basically an illusion, and that things that we do to ourselves that are bad, we just need to forget them because they're not real. This is a kind of a link. Even in 92, 93, I was telling my students, this is not New Age, this is old New Age. This is this whole philosophy that kind of takes a little bit of Eastern religion and mixes it with American self-improvement. And the next thing you know, you have a philosophy that sells millions and millions and millions of books. So does that make any sense?
Yeah, but what did you make of the New York Times feature on Williamson and, surprisingly, her beliefs?
Well, I was surprised that they dared to raise some of the doctrinal questions. Now, I didn't think they went far enough back into what A Return to Love said. The main purpose of the article, and this was perfectly valid, was to introduce a little bit of the history of A Course in Miracles and why that has lasted for decades and has been important. And then you had to say that, oh, yeah, by the way, Beyonce likes this a whole lot. And so you maybe heard of Cher, the Kardashians, among the world of self-help, the fact that Deepak Chopra, who came along around the same time and reached the American public through the Oprah doorway as well. You know, that's a lot to cover in a story. So I frankly thought the New York Times story was way better than I expected. I thought it's pretty good. And the fact that it tossed in there an old Psychology Today quote, which described the course as a crucial development in the American supermarket of religion, the supermarket of, quote, cults, religions, and psycho-mystical movements. That's pretty loaded language to put in the New York Times for about someone who's seeking the Democratic presidential nomination.
What do you think was missed in that New York Times story? What questions needed to be asked about Williamson's beliefs?
Well, I mean, you needed to go back and see what she says about sin. And you need to go back and ask her, oh, a question about what's gone wrong with the world. I mean, that there is bad in our world, in which she basically says, that's all an illusion. Let me just read one or two quotes from my old marked up first edition of the hardback of A Return to Love. I've done a little bit of trimming in here, but this is crucial material. When we think with God, then life is peaceful. When we think without Him, life is painful. Asking God for help doesn't seem very comforting if we think of Him as something outside of ourselves, or capricious, or judgmental. But God is love, and He dwells within us. We were created in His image or mind, which means that we are extensions of His love, or sons of God. Now, I've read this to some friends, and someone says, well, isn't that what Eastern Christianity means by theosis? Well, saying that God can make us a part of Himself in eternity is not the same thing as that we are living as sons of God with a capital S and a capital G right now. And then later, she carries this section over to a famous quote from A Course in Miracles, "Only love is real. Nothing else actually exists. If a person behaves unlovingly, then that means that regardless of their negativity, anger, or whatever, their behavior was derived from fear and it doesn't actually exist. They're hallucinating. You forgive them then because there's nothing to forgive. Well, that's an interesting thing to say to a world with nuclear weapons, abortion, global warming, massive starvation, ISIS, and a whole lot of other things. I mean, you find yourself, you know, thinking of facing the ISIS folks on a beach in Libya with a row of Christians preparing to die and saying, there's nothing to forgive here because these ISIS guys are just hallucinating. That's kind of hard to take. But then the quote that I underlined and read to my students over and over is this one. A sin would mean we did something so bad that God is angry with us. But since we cannot do anything that changes our essential nature, God has nothing to be angry at. Only love is real. Nothing else exists. The Son of God cannot sin. Now, who is the Son of God? At this stage already, all of us. Well, that's a very interesting and very unconventional concept of sin. What happened to the fall? What happened to good and evil? What happened to theodicy and questions about how an all-loving God allows the reality of free choice in a world? I mean, there's a lot of theological stuff going on there. The Times got to some of it, and I don't blame them for not going deeper. But if she's in this election much longer, somebody needs to write a story about why even liberal Christian theologians would be upset with some of this, let alone traditional Catholics, traditional Orthodox, traditional Protestants, etc. What she's saying is very wild stuff. In terms of religion, at the debates, you're going to see her then apply this to foreign policy, to domestic policy, to the national budget, to a host of other things, the sort of things that would happen when she's chatting with Oprah. And the fact that Americans don't know how to unpack this and decode this is really important. I would think that people that actually agree with her may not understand why they agree with her. One other thing I would say, the only thing that unites the far left side of the American political cultural landscape, according to the Pew Forum and that great pollster that I've quoted many times, John C. Green of the University of Akron, what unites people over there on the far left side of the cultural landscape, where you have agnostics, you have atheists, you have religious liberals, you have the religiously unaffiliated, you have a whole host of people. What unites them is their rejection of traditional Judeo-Christian, and I would also say Muslim for the most part, Judeo-Christian sexual morality as it relates to sex and marriage. Well, Marianne Williamson is right there with them, as is Oprah when push comes to shove. So is there some potential for a person, a Donald Trump-like celebrity figure only on the left, trying to get into American politics in a big way and having an impact? I think we would have to say yes.
Terry Mattingly is our guest. We're talking about media coverage of the religious beliefs of Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson. A little bit later, also former presidential candidate, the late Ross Perot. When we come back, did the New York Times explore at all what kind of policy implications would flow from a president who believes that every bad thing that happens in the world is really just an illusion?
Memoria Press now offers 8 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for children with special needs. These full-year packages help you teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art and music, poetry, science, history, Latin, classical and Christian studies in incremental and multisensory ways for mastery. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR9 to save on resources for your home or school.
If you appreciate Issues Etc., Talk Radio for the Thinking Christian, and Lutheran Public Radio, Sacred Music for the World, please include a bequest in your will or trust for these worldwide media resources. Bequests aren't subject to federal tax or capital gains taxes. Ensure your children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren the opportunity to listen by including a bequest in your will or trust for Issues Etc. and Lutheran Public Radio.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century. The 16th century. The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about media coverage of the religious beliefs of Democratic presidential candidate Marianne Williamson and former presidential candidate the late Ross Perot. Terry Mattingly is our guest, senior fellow for media and religion at the King's College in New York City, author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He's founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, did the New York Times piece explore in any way what kind of, you had mentioned policy implications, what kind of policy implications would be in store for an America where Marianne Williamson, who does not believe that bad things that happen in the world are real, sitting in the White House?
No, not really. And frankly, that was part of what surprised me. I was expecting a piece that took like every single thing she said at the debate and tried to talk about this in political terms. You know that one of the things we do at Get Religion is constantly point out to people that the press seems to operate in a world where only the political is real. And religion is only important to the degree that it affects partisan politics. So I expected more of that angle in this piece. And I'd have to say that I was glad that they devoted more attention to her history and the history of A Course in Miracles and how that affected her. Now, in terms of how that affects the budget or how that affects social policy, it talked a lot about her activism in the AIDS era, and it talked about how she believes the environment is extremely crucial. But it didn't really get into brass tacks. I don't think we're there yet. I think we're at the who was that lady stage. I mean, in terms of the public being reintroduced to her face and her voice in such a completely different location.
I sometimes gauge these things by how they're treated by the late night talk shows.
Yeah.
And to my knowledge, there was only one send-up of Marianne Williamson's debate performance by Kate McKinnon of SNL on one of the late night shows. And it was precisely this kind of staring off into space and uttering New Age truisms that was
right.
the butt of the joke.
It's so ironic that that is fair game on SNL, but I would imagine it would not be fair game for conservative commentators or someone else to mock her. And what I hope I'm doing is the opposite of mockery. The reason I wanted seminary students to read her book for themselves, first page to last, mark it up, ask people in their churches about it. I wanted them to take it seriously, that this is now a part of the religious makeup, Oprah America. It's a part of the religious makeup of kind of the center, the mushy middle of the American faith marketplace. And I think we're totally naive if we don't think that has the potential to then affect our politics. And to make that point again, I'll go right back to where I started when I answered, you know, your first question. How big a story would it be if the person standing up there as the presidential candidate was Oprah, and her announced vice presidential candidate then was one of the rising star faces of the Democratic Party left? Oh, okay. What if the candidate, the ticket that's starting to work together and trying to pull their weight together, what if it was Oprah and Mayor Pete Buttigieg? Would that be serious? I mean, then even the Democratic's nightmare would be, what if they weren't treated well, and what if she decided to run as a third-party candidate? What would that do to the left? I think it would send them into abject panic, because she's going to get, especially if it was Oprah, not Marianne Williams, she's going to get votes. The issue is whether there are enough votes there to threaten the machinery of the party. And don't you think surely the Democrats learned from what happened to the Republicans in 2016 when they basically had, you know, 666 candidates in the race at the same time, and Trump was able to start picking off the early winner-take-all primaries with 26, 27, 28% of the vote, and then all of a sudden you look up and he's got more delegates than everybody else. I'm not saying that will happen again with the Democrats, but I think you're going to see more pressure from the Democratic establishment to get some of these tiny audience candidates to get them out of the race so that that doesn't happen again. And it will be interesting to see what kind of respect she's treated with when that moment comes.
One of the other big stories in politics this week was the death of Ross Perot. I find him personally one of the most fascinating political figures in recent history. He was another outsider. He helped create one of the biggest political events in the late 20th century. That was the fall of George H.W. Bush and the rise of the Clintons. Were there any religion hooks in that story?
Oh, yeah. They were there, but there were almost none in the coverage. Now, once again, with Ross Perot, do we have Donald Trump in the White House right now without Ross Perot's assault on the political mainstream and television? I don't think we do. I think you can, in many ways, draw a line from the mindset of the people who marched, literally, in some cases, for Perot. I mean, you'd say it would be Perot, Tea Party, failed Tea Party, more anger, Trump. Is that a...
He lit the fire.
Yeah, definitely he lit the fire. Now, the question I kept wanting to see the press ask is one that I asked a lot at the time. And once again, as your basic old guy, you know, I remember reading the coverage of all this. I watched it all happen. I was someone who actually thought Bill Clinton, you know, until things blew up in that campaign, I thought he represented a kind of compromise, more conservative Southern Democratic option. This is someone who was not pure pro-abortion rights. His wife was, but he wasn't when he was governor of Arkansas. He had never whispered a word of liberalism on marriage and family and social issues. Okay, so you have Clintons, but where would American political life be today if the Bill Clinton era had not started when it did? In my lifetime, I would say that the Clinton era might be the single biggest, most divisive thing that's happened in America after Roe v. Wade and before Trump. I mean, the Clinton era was a soap opera, constant warfare, etc. Who gave us the Clinton era. Well, I know there are people who try to split the details and say that he didn't do it, but I find it very hard to see Bill Clinton getting elected with a minority of the American voting public if there isn't some sort of split in the world that was called conservative. And let's face it, Ross Perot was a kind of conservative. And the question I kept wanting to see people ask was, why did Perot do it? Why did Perot take down George Herbert Walker Bush? Now, they're both rich Texans. There has been all kinds of information through the years that there was a falling out between these two rich, powerful Texans. And what was that all about? Well, I dug back and found a 1992 feature in the New York Times that I thought in two paragraphs perfectly captured this and pointed toward why Perot was so offended by George Bush. There was more, the Persian Gulf War was part of it, Persian Gulf War 1.0. That was part of it, but there's something else going on here. And listen to this section of this story carefully. Mr. Perot espoused a kind of fiscal conservatism, and toward the end of his campaign, a strong law and order theme. But he also drew cheers when he staunchly defended a woman's right to choose abortion, and he bashed the religious right. Indeed, in a voter survey, only 34% of Mr. Perot's voters said they attended religious services at least once a week, compared with 42% of the survey sample as a whole. Mr. Perot's army seemed to include a strong libertarian streak. People seeking a measure of freedom from what they perceived as the heavy hand of institutions, religious as well as governmental. If the fundamentalist right holds sway in the coming battle for the soul of the Republican Party, Perot's followers could go elsewhere. By the way, he was also pro-gay rights at that time. And that's a stage where Barack Obama and Bill Clinton aren't pro-gay rights. But Ross Perot was. And he was not only strongly pro-abortion rights, his wife is on the board, or is it the advisory board, of the Dallas Planned Parenthood Association. They're giving lots of money to it, and he was a very outspoken defender of Planned Parenthood. And in Texas, that's not maybe as mainstream as is somewhere else. So he was a rich, mainline Protestant, libertarian conservative. And for someone who grew up in Texas like I did, the fact that he's from Highland Park, mm-hmm. neighborhood within Dallas, is basically all you need to know. I mean, that is the richest of the rich, the most elite of the elite. I mean, for them, rich people in Houston would be commoners. I mean, Highland Park is its own world. And you could make a case, and I've always wanted to see more coverage of it. There was more of it at the time that noted that his anger at Bush was because of Bush's willingness to court the religious right and specifically those who opposed abortion. If you'll remember, Mrs. Bush never did change her views on abortion. She stayed where she was, always defended Planned Parenthood. But George Herbert Walker Bush said he changed. Was this dance with the religious right one of the things that made Ross Perot or inspired Ross Perot to literally change American history? I thought that deserved at least a sentence or two in the main obituaries, and we didn't get it.
Terry Mattingly is Senior Fellow for Media and Religion at the King's College in New York City. He's author of the weekly On Religion column for the Universal Syndicate and the book Pop Goes Religion. He is founder and editor of Get Religion. Terry, thank you very much for being our guest.
Glad to be here.
When we come back from this break, we pick up our series introducing the books of the Bible again. We're moving from Old Testament to New Testament, so we'll do a little New Testament introduction before we introduce the book of Matthew with Pastor Brian Wolfmiller.
substitute organist service has been a great blessing for our worship life here at Christ the King Lutheran in Riverview, Florida.
Pastor Kevin Yoakum on the substitute organist service.
Now our organ plays rich liturgical music every single Sunday, and it's very affordable. You pick the hymns, you pick the liturgies. It's very simple. Just know when to push play.
You can find out more about the substitute organist service at churchmusicsolutions.com, churchmusicsolutions.com.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
Did you know that Luther Academy has been providing continuing education for confessional Lutheran pastors and laypeople worldwide for more than 20 years? Luther Academy publishes Logia, the Confessional Lutheran Dogmatics Series, and Luther Digest. Find out more about Luther Academy and sign up to receive their free email newsletter at lutheracademy.com, lutheracademy.com, and like them on Facebook, facebook.com/lutheracademy.
Emmanuel Press is a Lutheran-owned business in Fort Wayne, Indiana, in operation since 2004. That's 15 years of publishing liturgical and devotional books, 15 years of collaborating with Lutheran authors, artists, and translators. Thanks to our loyal customers and Issues Etc., we look forward to many more years of confessing and teaching the Christian faith. Visit us online at emmanuelpress.us. emmanuelpress.us.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's a monthly magazine on faith and life, theology and culture that helps readers interpret the contemporary world from a Lutheran Christian perspective. Filled with expert insights, good writing, and inspiring stories, it also provides essential church information for LCMS members. What is the Lutheran Witness? Simple. It's the flagship periodical of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and it has been for more than a century. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe today.
I'm talking with regular guest Dr. Ken Sherb about a new book by one of his former professors. Which one, Ken?
The late Dr. Kurt Marquardt, and the book is The Saving Truth, Doctrine for Laypeople.
You edited this book.
Yeah, the unpublished manuscript was among Marquardt's papers, and it is vintage Marquardt, lively, engaging, centering in the Christ who saves, with an apologetics chapter at the end.
You can find out more about Saving Truth, Doctrine for Laypeople at lutheracademy.com.